right. Hopefully I'm on the air now. How's that for interesting? All right. This is Jake McClure. Once more into the breach, dear friends. Evidently, the ghost of KTEM has been striking left and right here. So once more into the breach, dear friends. Else close the wall up with our English dead. The breach is a little bit more full today with the dead than usual. Heard that the program before us had some pretty significant technical difficulties. If I'm having technical difficulties today, you can blame it on my intelligence. That's all it is. This is the Personal Wealth Coach. I'm Jake McClure. Jeff McClure is on vacation. Give him a little round of applause. He deserves it. He's up in the mountains of the Rockies. Enjoying the weather. He sent me an email last night saying it's cold at night, a little too warm in the day, beautiful blue skies right next to a mountain brook chuckling at him. And he said as soon as he's done with the altitude sickness headaches, everything's going to be good. He's taken the whole month. He'll be up there enjoying himself, thankfully. Man, he deserves it. He's been working hard. So, this is the Personal Wealth Coach, and usually we give the disclosure right after the music, but the music and the talking didn't quite line up properly. So the Personal Wealth Coach is also an SEC-registered investment advisory firm. That means it's a fiduciary business. It works in the best interests of its clients. I and old Baldy Jeff are the principals of that firm. Just because it's registered with the Securities and Exchange Commission does not mean that they approve anything about us. In fact, if you ask the SEC, they don't approve anything about anything. So just keep that in mind. They are who regulates us. So if I say something incredibly stupid and dangerous, they're the people that you should talk to about it. Hopefully I won't say anything dangerous. The incredibly stupid, that's up to your perspective. Let's see. What are some of the other disclosures? Number one, just because the other entity that is part of this program is a registered investment advisory firm does not make what I'm saying today on the radio, or any day on the radio for that matter, investment advice. This is education. Why do we go on about this every week? It isn't to cover liability. That's a nice thing. You know, you get the legal disclosures and disclaimers. You try to read the fine print on the television as the car advertisement goes by. And if you can read that, I'm impressed. Why am I telling you that what I'm saying right now is not investment advice? Because investment advice is customized to you individually. And if I customize the investment advice to you individually on the air, it would be a gross breach of privacy. If I customized it to everyone in general, it wouldn't be customized to you. So education is something that is important in any investment decision. So hopefully we'll be giving you some of that for the foreseeable future. I'm going to do my best today. We've got some subjects to talk about today. Well, another couple of disclosures before we go any farther. We don't get paid to do this radio program. We also don't pay to do the radio program. However, the firm does advertise on the station, and that's something that should be known. We're doing it at market rates, not at any kind of a discount on that. So that should alleviate some of the sensitivities of, is this a paid commercial program? It isn't. It's an educational program, and KTEM has always been a pretty amazing station for that reason. They've allowed us to get on here and talk to you for lots of years through four different owners of the studio since 1998. I've been doing this. My dad did it the year and a half before that. He started it at the end of 1996. So if you do the math on that, you're going to find it's a long time. Those of you that have been listening for that entire time have heard my maturity level change over the years from someone that didn't know a whole lot about a whole lot, but didn't know how much I didn't know. Now I'm beginning to figure out that I don't know a lot about a lot of things. Hopefully I know enough that I can help other people that know less. And that's something rather important. Okay, so what happened this week in the market? Well, in the economy in general, but specifically in the market, we had not a lot of good news this week. A lot of the news was on hurricane, trade war. It'd be easy to think that the market was going to be all messed up because of all of the negativity that's been going on in the news. Instead, with the usual perverseness of the U.S. stock market, the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index surged upward on Thursday, then held its ground to close out the week at 2926.46. That's up 2.8% for the week. That's pretty fantastic. But lest we get too excited about the market's resurgence, it's only up about 0.86% from a year ago. And it's down 3.4% from its recent high about 5 weeks ago. So what is going on? What caused that to jump up? And the first thing to say about anyone that claims to know for certain what caused the market to do anything is beware of those people, because they really don't. They just think they do. We can give you some points of interest to say this may have been part of it. The U.S. consumer, it has been the plow horse in this case. Now, the U.S. consumer has been spending a lot. Both major retailers and Dell's PC sales posted unexpectedly high sales figures. The market is still clearly fixated on the trade war between China and the United States. There's an interesting phenomena there, because there's a rumor going around, even among well-known commentators on the economy, that the trade war that we have is with China. Why do I say that's a rumor? It seems everybody should say, of course the trade war is with China. Not only with China, and this is the thing that I need to remind people of. The trade war, when it started, was aimed at the entire world. It was about steel, and that's because China was dumping steel. No, it was not in U.S. markets anyway, and you can be shocked at that for a moment. We only imported about 1% of our imports, and our imports were only about 23% of our total steel. So 1% of 23%, and I don't mean 22% wasn't from China and 1% was. I mean 1% of the 23. So if all of our imports, 1% were from China. If our imports are 100% of our imports, 1% from China. So the steel issue, yes, steel prices were down because China was producing a lot of steel. But we slapped our tariffs on Canada, on Mexico, on all of Europe, on everyone. There were some minor delays on that, in that some countries were able to stay selling us steel for a while longer. South Korea was one of those. We've removed the tariffs on steel and aluminum from Mexico and Canada, but they still exist across the board on everything else. And so do a lot of other tariffs. So that's to say that we're only in a trade war with China. That's the rumor. People are passing that around. That's not the case. We're in a full on, anytime you look at a comparison in history, this would be known as a major trade war. If we were to compare it to like the Great Depression when the Smoot-Hawley Act was passed, it's not as extreme in some ways as that. It's targeted to specific products and types, but there are now so many products and types that I can just very easily say this is a trade war. It's the largest trade war that we've had since right after World War One, that the world has had since right after World War One. So one of the things I wanted to talk about on this subject, why is it that the trade war is being given the blame for slowing manufacture and slowing trucking? And there's a whole series of things that we're looking at in the economy, and it comes back to the trade war. It isn't the amount that the United States government is charging on tariffs. Because if you just do the math on that and you look at the entire size of our economy, the amount that we're charging on tariffs amounts to about less than 1% of our economy in a given year. So why is it causing such phenomenal strangeness in the economy? And this is one of my favorite topics. It has nothing to do with the current situation. It wouldn't be favorite if this was the reason why I decided to study it. It's my favorite because it's kind of the law of unintended consequences. In a perfect world, we could say this is less than 1% of our entire everything, so it's not going to have a big impact on anybody. Unfortunately, that's not how it works. Because there are portions of our economy that only do exports, and there's portions of our economy that don't do exports at all. And those two portions also do business with each other. So if you think about it from a perspective of a bank, if a bank, let's go back to It's a Wonderful Life type bank. Let's go to the to the realm of this wonderful savings and loan that's owned by the people that invest in it, that deposit in it. It's this sweet, happy feeling when a bell rings, an angel gets its wings kind of situation. If you remember that movie, there was a run on the savings and loan. And Jimmy Stewart famously stands up on the counter and says, "Your money's not here. It's in Jim's house. It's in," and so on. It's loaned out. That's the reality of the financial world in general. The reality of the financial world in general is that a bank holding your money and also making loans has a bigger impact on what goes around in the local economy than the hardware store does. However, if the hardware store has a loan from the bank, and its sales are down and it misses the loan from the bank, well, now the bank's in trouble. And the bank, if it's got a couple of businesses that are in trouble, stops giving loans or slows down on the loans until they know how much they're getting back. That then causes people to worry that maybe the bank doesn't have enough money and can cause this big run on the bank where everybody shows up and says, "I want my money." And they used to happen a lot more than they do today. People are, even with the nervousness around banks, people are a little bit more confident. The bank's going to be there. FDIC is there. We've got all these things in place that weren't around in the 1920s and 30s of the era that the movie took place in, Jimmy Stewart's famous speech in there. So the ripple effect of one hardware store causing the bank to slow down, causing a run on the bank, and maybe causing a big depression in the local economy if the bank fails. That's a ripple effect of one business. One business in a trade war is magnified across to a lot of businesses, and those businesses owe money to banks, owe money to other businesses. They have contracts with businesses that may or may not be profitable, just like any other business. So if you've just ordered a bunch of steel from someone and they've been doing business with you for a long time and the price is about to go up, but you got your order in, they didn't order on their end fast enough, so they lose some money on this contract, which makes it so that they can't make their loan payment, which causes them to go under, which means the next time you go to order steel, there's nobody there that your normal steel purchaser goes to the normal steel buying location, and they can't buy steel there. So they have to go somewhere else and possibly pay at a much higher rate. That's how the market works. Nothing that I have said in the last 20 minutes or so should be a surprise. This is stuff that anybody that's in business or around business, you know. Let's go back to the hardware store. You are ordering dog food. The dog food comes in. You sell the dog food. You go to order the dog food, and the person that's selling the dog food isn't there anymore. Where do you get the dog food? Well, now you've got to start looking around. You've not got the dog food on the shelf, so your customers aren't buying the dog food from you either. They may change who they buy from as well. you may have a permanent drop in sales because you missed having an item for a couple of weeks. That's just the nature of business. If you show up at a grocery store for a specific item and they don't carry that item and it's an important item to you, you're likely to change grocery stores. People don't tend to have a lot of loyalty to grocery stores. They don't tend to have a lot of loyalty to steel manufacturers. People tend to want what they want when they want it for the price they want it for. When they can't get that, they start looking around. If prices are going up, they grudgingly pay it. But they don't necessarily stay with the same place. If you think about the relationships that you have with people that sell you things, kind of across the board, whether that's where you buy your car or who you buy your house through or whatever it is, think about how often you've used the same person to do it. For the majority of people, it's more circumstance-based than loyalty-based. Well, I know who that is, so I'm going to give them a call. That's an important factor to remember when we're talking about tariffs. The wealth of nations is what was the birth of what we call capitalism today. The Wealth of Nations was a multi-part volume written by Adam Smith. And he is widely pronounced the father of capitalism. He's a Scotsman. I've been to his gravesite in Scotland. That says he's at least semi-important because we go to important economic people's dying places, I guess. I guess some people go into art history and they'll go and see where Van Gogh was. We go and see where economists were. And early in this, Adam Smith wrote this book, The Wealth of Nations. It is the fundamental, the foundation of what we call capitalism today. Well, what was the subject of The Wealth of Nations? What was it on? A tremendous portion of those volumes was on tariffs, because that was the most common taxation methodology of governments at the time. The income tax didn't exist yet. At the time, how do you get people to tell you how much money they make? If you think about that for a second, we went to that, and it requires a relatively honest society to come forward and say, I made this much money, unless you have a team of people that are willing to go out and really dig into this. Well, that's what the IRS does. The IRS goes in and really digs into it. Before that, it was tariffs. It's really easy to charge tariffs because you control all the points of entry into a country, all of the ports. And this is where customs comes from. The whole thing about customs, that's the form of taxation that the United States ran on for the majority of its history, up until the early 20th century when we went over to the income tax. Tariffs are a tax. So what's the difference between a tariff and a sanction? Because, for instance, North Korea or Russia. Russia invades Ukraine, takes a big chunk of another country and keeps it. So the world in general says, we're not going to do business with you, or we're not going to do business in this area, or if we do business, you have to pay a certain percentage of what you receive to us for doing business. That sounds a lot like a tariff, that last one, where if we're doing business with them, we're going to take a portion of that. It also sounds like a sales tax. I mean, that's how we run the state of Texas's budget. A big part of it also comes from oil and gas taxation. People don't realize that in a lot of cases, but if you dig into the budget of the state of Texas, you'll see a fairly substantial portion of the tax revenue that runs the government here comes from oil and gas. Well, it makes sense because they're a big strain on our economic system if we didn't have some money to build roads and to educate workers and so on off of that money. It wouldn't function well in the future. We would lose our oil and gas revenue. Before I go any further on that subject, what do I mean we would lose oil and gas revenue if we didn't take taxes out of it? Well, Saudi Arabia is a good example of that. They have not been re-educating themselves on how to drill for oil very well. Most of the oil, the vast majority of the oil that's drilled and pulled up, that's owned by Saudi Arabia, is oil, it's drilled and pulled up by non-Saudi Arabians. In fact, the vast majority of the oil workforce in Saudi Arabia is Texan. Think about that for a second. So if you think about the effect of Texas on the global oil price, it's not just here with fracking. We're also everywhere else that oil is being drilled. I mean, if we're in the North Sea, Texans are kind of the point people on getting oil out of the ground across the world. So how is it that us taking tax revenue off of oil in Texas is good for oil? Well, a lot of that money goes back into education in Texas. If Texans are getting an education in mineral rights or in geology or in fluid dynamics or in software engineering for use in three-dimensional mapping of geological strata, you can see where this leads to a continued world domination by Texas in the area of oil. It also helps us run our government. So it's a sales tax that's being applied consistently. The big thing that Adam Smith said about tariffs is that if you want to have a successful economy, period, you need to be clear in the amount you're charging and when people will have to pay and when they won't have to pay. It needs to be very clear from the beginning or it stifles growth. One of my favorite forms of taxes is the sales tax. So if you know what the sales tax is going to be, that is truly a volunteer tax. People say that the income tax is supposed to be volunteer, but it's only volunteer in that you have to volunteer to work in order to make money so that you can pay taxes. Otherwise, it's a mandatory tax. If you make money, you've got to pay taxes. In a sales tax situation, particularly in Texas, there's a whole series of things that don't get taxed. Unprepared food. This is something that is necessary for life. If you're cooking, you can buy your food without paying sales tax on it. Truly, it's a voluntary thing. There are also weekends that you can buy a bunch of other stuff sales tax free based on the holiday that the state says, hey, nobody has to pay. We're making enough money. So a sales tax, when it's known, when people know what the tax is as far as most economists are concerned, the least negative on the growth. It is the most inclusive of growth going forward in an economy. So why would a tariff be a bad thing? Well, tariffs by themselves are not bad things. And I know people that have been listening to this program for the entire trade war have heard us lambasting the tariffs, talking about how bad the tariffs are. It isn't the tariffs themselves that are bad. It's the uncertainty about the tariffs that are bad. That is the biggest piece of a problem in any economy, uncertainty. It is hard to make a decision on what your profit might be for the coming year if you don't know what your expenses are going to be for the coming year. Most of the time, people can make an assumption. They're going to look something like they did last year. My expenses aren't that much bigger, so I should, if I've got higher sales, I should have more profit. If the tax code changes constantly, you have no idea what your profitability will be. And we've been seeing that in the S&P 500 earnings reports. There's a lot more surprises, both on the upside and the downside, than we're used to. Since the Enron debacle, the Arthur Andersen Enron debacle, where they were reporting earnings that weren't real, the analysts and the CEO are held to a much higher legal standard when they're talking about possible earnings. So for the last decade, it's been pretty unusual to have a major surprise on earnings. Because people, before they say this is what we think earnings are, they have to have a pretty good idea that this is correct. They can go to jail if they do it wrong. The CEO This is the part of the Dodd-Frank Act. The CEO of the corporation can go to jail for talking about earnings that they don't believe exist. So come forward to today. If you're planning something as a business owner, you want to, maybe you want to get into manufacturing. Maybe you want to, here's a good one. There's several companies that are getting into the rare earth metals. Now I've just gone into an area that most people have no idea what I'm talking about. Rare earth metals are involved in electronics and in batteries and in basically all of the new things that we're doing. They require a pretty good stream of rare earth metals to do it with. They're not really rare. They call them rare earth metals because of the way they appear, not how often they appear. The concentration, because you probably have rare earth metals in your backyard dirt, but they're not concentrated very much. So finding them all concentrated in one spot is pretty important. About 97% of the rare earth metals for the world right now come from China. They used to come at about that same percentage before China in the 1970s and 1980s. They came from the United States. They came from California. One of the other problems with rare earth metals is that when you pull them up, the refining process is messy. I mean, if you think about what's in your batteries and your computer or your phone, it's a lithium battery. Lithium is one of those metals, if you recall back to your chemistry, that has some interesting characteristics, like catching on fire in the wrong circumstances. Sodium is another one that's a rare one. It's not that they're really rare, it's just rare in concentration. So we've got these very necessary components coming from China. Well, the Trump administration has been very careful not to include those in the tariffs so far. They've not been tariffed. Well, why? Well, because everybody needs them and we don't have a replacement for them, so it would just cause the price to go up. Well, there's several companies that are saying, all right, we're going to get into it in the United States. They're running into a lot of problems. It costs a lot of money to refine these products without really destroying the entire neighborhood. So we can get into it and say, hey, it's the EPA and they're stopping business. But why did the EPA come to exist? I don't mean in their most pit bull form. I mean at all. It was not a one party versus another party situation that caused the EPA to exist. The EPA came into existence with the backing of just about the entire American people, because we had rivers that were catching on fire and then staying on fire. We had rain that would eat through your umbrella and burn your head. These are problems, and we haven't had those problems in a while because we made the EPA. Well, the EPA comes in and says, all right, to prevent these things, we've got to do these things. Now, the ecological laws tightened over time to include a lot of things that the original EPA didn't, and business owners said, hey, we're taking it to another level now. It's really getting expensive. And just as a side note to explain that, 99% of pollution doesn't cost a whole lot to get rid of. So if you're a coal power plant or a steel refinery, 99% of your pollution can get stopped using some rather inexpensive methods. And the original forming of the EPA said, hey, everybody do this. It's not that expensive. Do it. Well, now it's moved into that last 1%. The last 1% is expensive. The steel refining process requires a platinum catalytic converter on a scale that costs tens of millions of dollars to prevent 1% of the already existing pollution. So that last 1% is the most expensive. So you get a lot of pushback, and that tends to be historically, at least in the last 40 or 50 years, that's been a Republican pushback, because it's businesses that have been mostly Republican, and they're saying, hey, we've really cut back. The rivers aren't on fire. It's not raining acid on us anymore. Look at all the benefit that we've gotten out of this. why are you making us pay a lot of money for this last bit when the rain's not burning us anymore? And the EPA is responding, well, it is still polluting. It is still, and this is our mandate. It's not our fault. Congress has said this is what we need to do. Okay, so we've had a bunch of pushback on that. The Trump administration has pushed back on that. Well, one area that they have not pushed back is that 99%, that first cheap area. And that first cheap area in rare earth is not cheap. Rare earth metals are just expensive to refine without really damaging the entire area around them, making it a wasteland, basically. That's why California is no longer the major contributor to the rare earth metal in the world. The mine that was the sole source of rare earth after World War II, all the way up until the 90s when the Chinese started picking it up, started getting taxed rather thoroughly by the state of California because they were making the land that they were on completely uninhabitable. I mean, this is not quite as bad as a nuclear disaster in that you could still walk through it without having your grandkids have weird mutations, but you were likely to get sick just walking through the area. Why am I focusing on this? Because it's a portion of our export-import situation where strategically we're at a major disadvantage. Major disadvantage. If we ever really went to war with China, we don't have a big reserve of rare earth metals. Maybe we could get those old mines back up and functional. But this is a big strategic issue. We are completely dependent on China for that. We've got a lot of tariffs with China. China's getting rather fed up with this. Right in the middle of this, there's a Hong Kong issue going on. I know it's not major news in the United States. I mean, it has headlines occasionally. But it's a big deal, guys. The issue in Hong Kong has the potential of changing the trade war into a hot war. Because we're clearly in support of the residents of Hong Kong, as is the UK and a lot of the Western world. Well, they are citizens of China. We are clearly supporting them in what the Chinese say is a act of hooliganism and maybe terrorism, and we're clearly supporting them at the same time that we have these tariffs going on. This is important across the board because the concept of a trade war as a standalone item is extremely rare in history when it doesn't include a hot war at the end of it. That's what led to World War II. This is more dangerous than just getting a new trade deal. We can get a new trade deal. If that's the effect that we get out of this, I'll be happy. But we're not seeing a lot of movement in that direction. We're seeing movement away from it, hard away from a new trade deal. That is not good. It's not good, and that's not an opinion. That is raw economics going back as far as you want. If you think, you know, Amazon is an amazing company. Oh, this sounds like, man, did I just do a whiplash subject change? No, it's the same subject. For decades, Amazon's profit was at zero or negative. Why was that? Well, because they were taking their earnings, all the profit that they would have had if they had just kept it, and plowing it back into increasing their market share. What is market share? Well, it means the amount of people in the market that go to you and buy from you. Part of increasing market share is increasing your marketplace, reaching out to new markets. If reaching out to new markets is part of what we consider growth, then limiting the markets that we can go to or raising the expense of new markets causes a slowdown. And if a company is already relatively leveraged, like Amazon has been in the past, where they've taken debt, even though they were making money, they turned around and plowed it back into their system, and then they took some debt to do even more spending. If the expense goes up on the new marketplace drastically while they're leveraged, it can put them out of business. So if we had a trade war in the late 1990s, Amazon may not exist. That's the point, the ripple effect. The little tariffs have a bigger magnified impact on the companies that are taxed with those little tariffs. The little tariffs are actually quite large for specific companies. And this is the trap of economics, to talk about the aggregate as if it's the reality. And my favorite thought on this is one that Ollie and I have said for years and years. Statistics are misleading. If you have 1 foot in dry ice and 1 foot in boiling water, your average temperature is fine. Your aggregate temperature is fine. But you are not comfortable. And I have a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. Enjoy the show. Calling from California this week.
All right.
You may have already covered this. When was the last time we had a trade war, potential trade war on this magnitude, and how long did it last, and what was the outcome?
Okay.
And I'm gonna hang on here.
Okay.
And listen, thanks.
Thanks for the call.
I did cover it, but it's worth covering again. The last time we had a trade war that was of this magnitude or bigger was right after the Great Depression, and we ratcheted it up throughout the Depression and coming out into World War II. It led to World War II. Smoot-Hawley, when anytime we have a tariff on a grand scale across the board, Smoot-Hawley was not as panicky and emotional as it seems like it is from hindsight. Smoot-Hawley was an act that increased tariffs across the board in the middle of the Great Depression because the government was concerned about revenue and they wanted to protect American jobs. And we had just recently for them, I mean, within the living memory of the politicians, gone from a tariff taxation system to the income taxation system. So going back to the tariffs, in the middle of this, they were thinking, well, maybe we went too far in taking those away so fast. It's costing American jobs, when the reality was the jobs weren't being lost because of imports. They were being lost because of automation. We had tractors in the field rather than people in the field, and that caused us to lose a lot of jobs. You can't tax other countries to make your workers not obsolete when they've been replaced with automation. We took the revenue from the Smoot-Hawley Act and formed a couple of organizations, ending with the Civilian Conservation Corps. These organizations were ruled kind of unconstitutional multiple times, so they got renamed and changed into something else. What got us out of it was a war, World War II, where we took a lot of unemployed people and threw them into an employed situation. Maybe not the kind of employment that they had been looking for, but a necessary form at that point. The reason why the Japanese considered themselves at war with us, they didn't think of it as a unannounced war when they attacked Pearl Harbor. You can look back at the Japanese version of that. They thought they were at war with us already because we were in a trade war. We were denying them raw materials for a lot of things, and Japan doesn't have a lot of raw materials. So to them, that was a very strategic thing that we were denying them. They thought this is what you do in a war. And if you compare that to sanction is one step below a war, a hot war. Calling it a tariff or calling it a sanction, particularly when the reason why we slapped on the steel tariffs was because of bad actions. The reason why we're in a trade war with China is because we call what they're doing bad actions. That sounds like a sanction. It's a targeted tariff based on actions, not based on revenue growth for the government. So China has responded with tariffs to us for our bad actions. This is what is defined as a war, where you've gone to a point where the negotiations are way behind the actions. I've got some commercials to play, and this is worth talking about a little bit more, because trade wars are not simple in any way you look at them, but they also don't have to be as complex in concept as people seem to think they are. I'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. We've got some commercials to play, and then I will come on back, and maybe we don't have commercials. This is maybe the ghost has struck again. Yep, it doesn't look like I have commercials. Can you tell if I have commercials? The technical difficulties are abundant this week here. Usually I have commercials, but doesn't look like it. So I'm going to go ahead and continue with this concept. We have, give you some examples. We are doing exceedingly well as an economy. We're not growing at massive rates, but our confidence is relatively high. Our incomes are up. Our standard of living is up. We had a big drop in our confidence in the last month. We had a drop and rise and drop and rise, a huge volatility of double-digit percentage points in trucking volume, which is not good, but it means that what we've seen up till now, people being completely overworked, maybe this was a enforced vacation for that time period. Oh, look, the spot block is filling it up on itself. The ghost is in the computer now. It's doing things. All right, so this concept of trucking, people that have listened to this program since the late 90s know that we see that as a major indicator of future activity. When we're looking out at trucking, what we're seeing is that's extra growth. People don't put goods on trucks that haven't been paid for. Somebody's paid for that or are paying for that. That means that future earnings based on the sale of those new items should be good coming forward. Yeah, all right, good. We've got, looks like it's not, I'm not sure if when to hit play on these things because they're appearing like magic in the computer in front of me. We'll get it figured out in a minute. So in August, the index on from the American Truck Association on the amount of tons, the tonnage index, was up 6.6% in July from the month before. That's good news, except that the month before was a massive negative. It was a massive negative in that what we see these huge jumps in growth. We didn't get the growth. Not only did we not get the growth, we moved backwards. That we had less. Now, if we go back a year, we're still up above what we were last year at this point on tonnage. So what does that mean? It means that we're doing well, but it's fluctuating. That fluctuation is based on inventory buildup. We're seeing this. It's like this. It really is a ripple effect. If you think of a graph with waves across it, if you look at the first graph is when the tariff goes into place. And the second graph is the purchases made by corporations before the tariff goes into effect to try to get the lower price as soon as possible. So there's this big surge in buying. Then the tariff hits, this big drop in buying. You come forward to the shipping time from wherever the items were being purchased, mainly China. So you come forward in time a month and a half. That's how long it takes sometimes to get across the Pacific on those big ships. Comes across the Pacific, hits the market. We have this big surge in trucking because a much larger inventory than usual is coming onto the shore. Surge in trucking. Everybody says we need to hire as many truckers as is possible. There's not enough truckers. Get your wife, get your husband, get your 8-year-old son. Get them driving. Then the next month hits and all these new people that have been scraped up into the workforce just have to do it because otherwise we can't meet this demand. Just think of all of the great trucking movies in the past of how you need to get the goods where they're going. You got to get there no matter what. You got to get them on time. So that mentality is still in the trucking world. If anything, it's magnified in the trucking world. So then the following month, you not only don't have a record amount at the docks, you have an absolute drop from the year before in the amount of goods showing up at the docks. Now you have a bunch of truckers that with nothing to do. So you see this ripple effect that you can overlay these graphs, and it's like you drop a pebble in the water and you watch the waves form around it. The tariff throws a whole bunch of decision-making processes out the window. People in trucking have made their decision based on rising demand for trucking. So in the past, that means, hey, this is probably going to last a while. Well, this was a temporary demand, and nobody bothered to tell the trucking companies about it. So that's not what they're looking at. They just got an order. When you order something in a big truck, you say, hey, I need this much stuff delivered. You don't say, and we're going to do the same thing next week and the next week. You do it for what you know you have at that moment. The trucking companies are making decisions based on, hey, this is going to continue. So what we're seeing in those graphs, and they're really cool graphs, I recommend people going to trucking.org. Trucking.org is the American Trucking Association's website, and they've got some really good graphs. Our trucking demand is above what it was last year. But if you look at the peaks and the valleys of this year compared to what's normal in the past, you have a relatively smooth line followed by zigzag, zigzag, up and down, up and down, up and down. That's not good for employment in that area. It's not good in the places that are receiving the goods because they've got to get substitute truck drivers and then they got to lay truck drivers off, and then you can understand that. It looks like the commercials are ready to go, so I'm going to try it now. Won't have a whole lot of time before the end of the hour. We'll continue this next hour. This is the Personal Wealth Coach. The number to call in here is 254-773-1400, and I'll be back on the other side.